You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. You know, something happened last week that we really need to be paying attention to. And that was when, in the Christian Science Monitor, President Bonnie Sauter, the former president of Iran, wrote an op-ed. Now, I mean, you know, there's... We could do the small stuff, and you know, we will talk about that. Senator John Cornyn, for example, he just issued this statement that an unacceptable national backlog of untested rape kits has compounded the pain for too many victims of sexual assault over the years. I'm pleased with the wide bipartisan support the SAFER Act received, and with the president's signature today, law enforcement can begin working immediately to test outstanding kits and see that justice is served. He's talking about the Violence Against Women Act, which he voted against. John Cornyn, Republican hypocrite, liar to the people of the state of Texas. I mean, it's worth pointing out. But I think there's something even bigger. The last half of the 20th century, since World War II, we've had five Republican presidents. And only one of them was legitimately elected. The other four held office because of election fraud and theft. The four Republican presidents since World War II were Eisenhower, Nixon, Reagan, and Bush Sr. and Bush Jr. Okay, Eisenhower ran as the peace candidate. You've got that clip, don't you, Sean? A vote for Eisenhower, Vote for Peace was his slogan in 1952. In fact, here's Eisenhower's TV ad from, you know, Eisenhower's campaign.
He has met Europe's leaders, has got them working with us. Elect the number one man for the number one job of our time. November 4th, vote for peace. Vote for Eisenhower.
A paid film, yeah. So, you know, vote for peace. Now, as president, Eisenhower then oversaw the continuation of Roosevelt's New Deal and began a massive government spending program, putting millions of young men through college for free. This is extending the GI Bill, building the interstate highway system, building thousands of new schools, paying for more than half the cost of construction of all new hospitals in the United States, and more than 80% of the cost of all college tuition. Eisenhower supported a 91% top marginal income tax rate on the rich, and approved of very popular New Deal programs like Social Security and unemployment benefits. It paid off the national debt from World War II and brought huge prosperity for working class people. When he ran for re-election, he bragged about it. 1956 Republican platform, I quote, "The federal minimum wage has been raised for more than 2 million workers." This is Republicans, 1956. Eisenhower. "Social Security has been extended to an additional 10 million workers, and the benefits raised for 6.5 million. The protection of unemployment insurance has been brought to 4 million additional workers. There have been increased workmen's compensation benefits for longshoremen and harbor workers, increased retirement benefits for railroad employees, and wage increases and improved welfare and pension plans for federal employees." Can you imagine a Republican talking like this today? He continued. Or the Republican Party platform, 1956. "All workers have gained, and unions have grown in strength and responsibility and have seen their membership increase by 2 million. Federal leadership has enlarged federal assistance for construction of hospitals, emphasizing low-cost care of chronic diseases and the special problems of older persons, and increased federal aid for medical care for the needy. We recommend to Congress the submission of a constitutional amendment providing equal rights for men and women." This is the last legitimately elected Republican president, Dwight Eisenhower. "The Eisenhower administration has eliminated discrimination in all federal employment." End of quote. People loved it. Eisenhower was easily reelected in 1956. Next two presidents were Democrats, Kennedy and Johnson. Johnson started the Vietnam War, and it wasn't going all that well. In 1968, his vice president, Hubert Humphrey, was running for election as president. And Johnson knew that Humphrey would easily win if Johnson could just end the war in Vietnam. If the war continued through the election, Nixon would win. So LBJ cut a deal with the Vietnamese to end the war. And then the CIA brought LBJ a wiretap. Now, LBJ was president. Humphrey, his vice president, was running for president. CIA brings LBJ a wiretap that they'd intercepted between the Nixon for President campaign and the office of the president of South Vietnam, Nguyen Van Thieu. Nixon basically told them that if they refused to go to the peace talks, or at least refused to go along with the peace agreement Johnson had worked out with them, then Nixon would give them a much better deal after the election. LBJ was furious. This was treason. And because he could actually listen to the CIA phone intercepts, he knew that Richard Nixon was at the heart of it. So he called the senior Republican in the entire U.S. Senate, Ever Dirksen. His name is on the Dirksen office building, two blocks from here. Ever Dirksen, one of the most honorable men to hold a Senate leadership position in generations, and told him what was going on. In fact, here's... Let's start with clip number five here, Shano. This is LBJ saying to Everett Dirksen, you know, I know what's going on, and I think this is treason.
Here's the latest information we got. The agent says that they just talked to the boss in New Mexico.
Uh-huh.
And that he says that you must hold out. Just hold on until after the election. We know what Chu is saying to them out there.
Yeah.
We're pretty well informed on both ends. Now, I'm reading their hand, Everett. I don't want to get this in the campaign.
That's right.
And they oughtn't to be doing this. This is treason.
I know.
This is treason. And Everett Dirksen goes, I know. Okay, so it continues. This is also from that clip. This is Everett Dirksen. This is LBJ saying, you know, I don't want the American people to know about this. And LBJ went to his grave with this secret, by the way. And Hubert Humphrey as well. Here's Lyndon Johnson again talking to Everett Dirksen, the Senate Republican leader, about what was going on with the Nixon campaign in the South Vietnamese.
And I'm calling you only after talking to Rusk and Clifford and all of them who thought that somebody ought to be notified as to what's happening. Now, I can identify them because I know who's doing this. I don't want to identify it. I think it would shock America if a principal candidate was playing with a source like this on a matter this important.
Yeah.
I don't want to do that. But if they're going to put this kind of stuff out, they ought to know that we know what they're doing. I know who they're talking to, and I know what they're saying.
And he mentioned his Secretary of State and his Secretary of Defense. They were the ones who told him to call Dirksen, he says. And then finally, this is LBJ's last call to Dirksen saying, you know, it looks like, you know, as long as Nixon's going to sabotage our efforts to end the war, he's probably going to be elected president, but it's going to bite him in the butt. He's going to end up with the legacy of the war. And Nixon and LBJ knew this well because basically, he couldn't run for re-election as a consequence of this. Here's Lyndon Johnson talking to Everett Dirksen about that.
Well, now, what do you think we ought to do about it?
Well, I better get in touch with him, I think, and tell him about it.
I think you better tell him that his people are saying to these folks that they oughtn't to go through this meeting. Now, if they don't go through the meeting, it's not going to be me that's hurt. I think it's going to be whoever's elected, and maybe my guess, him.
Yeah.
And I think they're making a very serious mistake, and I don't want to say this.
Yeah.
And you're the only one I'm going to say it to.
Yeah.
So this is pretty straightforward stuff. This is how Richard Nixon stole the election in 1968, by blowing up the peace negotiations with the Vietnam War. Now we've got proof that Reagan stole an election.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And this was just in the Christian Science Monitor last week. Share that with you right after this, 15 minutes past the hour. Okay, so we just went through how Richard Nixon, the first of the five Republican presidents since World War II, or the second of the five, the first illegitimately elected, of the four illegitimately elected president. Richard Nixon stole the election in 1968. He, of course, had to resign. Gerry Ford became president. He was never elected, so it kind of doesn't matter. Then you had, coming out of the Carter presidency, coming out of the Ford presidency, we had Jimmy Carter, legitimately elected. And after the Carter presidency, we had Ronald Reagan running for office. And this is where it gets really interesting. But in fact, let me get into this, and then, we'll talk about George W. Bush, I guess, the next segment. Clip number one. I'm getting ahead of myself here. And I want to move right to the new stuff. Here's what happened. Bonnie Sauter. Bonnie Sauter was that's his last name, was the candidate for president of Iran. And there we are. And he was, when the movie Argo came out, the movie Argo basically portrays the Iranian people as bloodthirsty, we want the hostages, all this kind of stuff. And so Bonnie Sauter comes out, and here's what he wrote for the Christian Science Monitor. He says, Ayatollah Khomeini and Ronald Reagan had organized a clandestine negotiation known as the October Surprise, which prevented the attempts by myself and then U.S. President Jimmy Carter to free the hostages before the 1980 U.S. presidential election took place. The fact that they were not released tipped the results of the election in favor of Reagan. Okay, this is the president of Iran. He says, I openly opposed the hostage taking throughout the election campaign, telling students that occupying an embassy in the heart of Tehran was a sign of cowardice rather than courage. I won the election with over 70% of the vote, in part on that platform. Other candidates were also openly against hostage taking, and overall 96% of the votes in that election, it was the election of 1980 in Iran, while the hostages were being held, 96% of votes in that election were given to candidates who were against it. Who were against the hostage taking. But the Reagan campaign, specifically Bill Casey, the chairman of the Reagan campaign, the guy that Reagan rewarded by making him head of the CIA, Bill Casey cut a deal with the Ayatollah as the president of Iran at that time, just wrote last week for the Christian Science Monitor, cut a deal with the Ayatollah to hold the hostages. Here's Ted Koppel talking about the crisis. I mean, this killed the Carter presidency. Here's Ted Koppel back in 1980.
For Jimmy Carter, day 444 begins just as the last 2 days have begun. Without sleep, exhausted, surrounded by aides in the Oval Office, President Carter is desperately trying to salvage this symbolic victory for his administration, to free the 52 American hostages before Ronald Reagan takes the oath of office at noon.
Now, this is, January, whatever it was, the day, inauguration day, in January of 1981. Here's Ted Koppel as, Jimmy Carter is about to go up and say, at the inauguration of Ronald Reagan. Here it is.
Reports of the hostage release are flying fast and furiously now. With Ronald Reagan's oath of office now only 30 minutes away, Jimmy Carter, on his way to the inaugural podium, is questioned by Sam Donaldson.
Mr. President, are the hostages out?
Can't say yet.
Not yet, Sam. Not yet.
Is that what he said, Frank?
I couldn't hear it. Not yet. Not yet.
They've cheated him. They've cheated him right down to the end.
They did. They cheated him right down to the end. And here's Ted Koppel as the hostages were freed as they were getting ready for it. Clip three.
But at 11:38, some 20 minutes before the oath of office, teletype alarm bells sound all over the world.
what's happening, and this will mean a lot more, I suppose, to journalists out there. UPI has just gone with a flash, which is, in effect, the highest, the most important notification of news that they can give. The last time they did it was with the Kennedy assassination. It's two words. It says, hostages freed.
Now, that was just as Reagan was about to take the podium. And here's Frank Reynolds. This is all ABC News, by the way, and tip of the hat to ABC. This is Frank Reynolds reporting on Reagan presidency day one. This is just moments after Reagan took the oath of office. Of course, the hostages were officially freed the minute that Reagan put his hand on the Bible, which was the Iranians' way of saying, hey, we kept your deal. Now send us the weapons that you promised, which is what became the Iran-Contra scandal. Here is Frank Reynolds.
Now, day one. Day one of Ronald Reagan's presidency, and day one of freedom for 52 Americans. Though thousands of miles apart, these two historic events moved almost on parallel tracks today. The new president had not been in office an hour when the former hostages became free men and women again.
There you go. And Jimmy Carter, you know, his fate was sealed. Bill Casey must have been feeling very, very, you know, in the catbird seat. He had cut a deal, just like Nixon cut a deal with the South Vietnamese, to extend the war in Vietnam so that Hubert Humphrey wouldn't become president. Just like that, in the exact same way, Ronald Reagan's guy, Bill Casey, his campaign manager, cut a deal with the Ayatollah. As the president of Iran is now stating out loud, to hold those hostages for those 444 days, even though 96% of the people of Iran didn't want it that way, which is why he's saying the movie Argo was highly inaccurate. It cut a deal with the Ayatollah to hold the hostages until Reagan was released in exchange for weapons, in exchange because they had a military that was all American hardware. You know, we'd given it to the Shah. They needed spare parts.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So basically, since Eisenhower, we all know about, Bush and the Supreme Court. Since Eisenhower, there has not been a legitimate Republican president. 34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. So here we have it. George W. Bush, the only way that he got elected was by having his brother Jeb, who himself now wants to run for president, having his brother Jeb and Jeb's buddy Kathleen Harris, the Secretary of State in Florida, knock 80,000 African-American legitimate voters off the voting rolls because they were committing the crime of voting while black, and they had similar last names to felons in the state of Texas. Like 80,000 Texas felons suddenly migrated to Florida in 1 year, and Jeb Bush had to purge them off the voting list. That got Bush and Gore within a couple hundred points of each other, so that the initial count went to Bush, and then when the recount was done a year later, as reported in the New York Times, buried in the 17th paragraph, by the way, because it was a month after 9/11, and they didn't want to diminish George Bush's standing during time of a national emergency. But there it was. You know, by any standard, if you recounted all the votes in the state of Florida, which is what the Florida Supreme Court had ordered, and it was put a stop to by the U.S. Supreme Court, by five to four vote on the U.S. Supreme Court. If you counted all the votes in Florida, Al Gore was president. And by the way, Al Gore won 500,000 more votes nationally than George W. Bush did. So Al Gore should have been president, but George W. Bush stole that election with the help of his brother Jeb in 2000. So you've got George W. Bush, an illegitimate president. You got Ronald Reagan, an illegitimate president, stole the presidency. And therefore, by extension, George Herbert Walker Bush, when he ran for president against Dukakis in what year would that have been? 88, thank you. In 88, you can complain about the campaign tactics, Willie Horton and all that kind of stuff, the lies and whatnot. But the fact of the matter is that George Herbert Walker Bush should not have been the incumbent vice president. And if he wasn't, he probably wouldn't have won the election. But in any case, so you've got, by extension, Bush Sr., an illegitimate presidency because he was on the back end of a presidency that was stolen, the Reagan presidency. And then you got Nixon stealing the presidency by extending the war in Vietnam, by, conspiring with them. And I think you can make a very strong case that Iran-Contra in 1980, and that Nixon's original October surprise, his Vietnam October surprise in 1968, were treason. As President Johnson called them to Everett Dirksen, the Republican, and Everett Dirksen said, yeah, I know. So here we have with, you know, every Republican president since World War II, except Dwight Eisenhower, who ran on a progressive, not just a liberal platform, a progressive platform, and won. But every Republican president since Dwight Eisenhower has basically stolen their office. And the Democratic presidents, you know, Jimmy Carter didn't want to go back and expose Nixon's crimes. He may not have known. I mean, it's entirely possible that Lyndon Johnson actually took that to his grave and never told anybody in the Democratic Party. Although Clark Clifford knew, Dean Rusk knew. I mean, he told Everett Dirksen that he talked to Clark Clifford and Dean Rusk. Everett Dirksen knew. I mean, there was a small circle of people, Democrats and Republicans, who knew that Nixon had stolen the 68 election by treason. But Jimmy Carter wasn't about to out them. I mean, Nixon was disgraced. He had resigned. Jerry Ford, his vice president, his second vice president, Spiro Agnew, his first vice president, had to resign because he was indicted in, what was it, New Jersey, Connecticut, wherever he was from, for fraud and mob activity, basically. So he got replaced with Jerry Ford, this kind of innocuous, bumbling congressman from Michigan who became president. And Ford couldn't pull off a re-election or an election. So Jimmy Carter became president, and Carter chose not to point out or prosecute Nixon for those crimes. And in fact, he couldn't have prosecuted him because Jerry Ford issued a pardon to Richard Nixon, not just for the Watergate crimes, but for any crime he may have ever committed in his life. Think about that one for a minute. I mean, this was Richard Nixon who took a $500,000 bribe from Jimmy Hoffa to stop the prosecution of the Sun Valley land deal in 1959, 1960, when he was vice president. I mean, you could, I suppose, call into question the legitimacy of the Eisenhower presidency simply by virtue of the fact Nixon was his vice president. But in any case, so Carter didn't blow the whistle. Clinton didn't blow the whistle. Clinton certainly knew what was going on with Iran-Contra. That was no secret this town. That was an open secret, you know. But there were whistleblowers. You had Barbara Honegger, who worked in the State Department. She wrote a book about it called October Surprise. You had Gary Sick, who was a reporter. He wrote a book about it, also called October Surprise, about how in 1980, the Reagan campaign, specifically Bill Casey, had cut a deal, had flown to Paris, met with the Ayatollah and his representatives, or at least his representatives, and said, and the Iranians at that time were freaked out because they had this huge military that the Shah of Iran had acquired over decades from the United States, and every single piece of hardware was American-made. And they had to have American-made spare parts, and they had to have American missiles, American-made missals, to fit into those rocket launchers, into those missile launchers. And guess what? A week after the deal was cut between Casey and the Ayatollah, now this was, you know, almost a year before Reagan took office. This was long before the elections. As soon as the deal was cut, the Israelis started shipping weapons at our request to Iran. So the Ayatollah was getting his payoff as it went along, and he kept the hostages. So, it's like there's that line that I'm forgetting the movie. I think it was, what's the movie where Slim Pickens is riding the bomb down to, in Dr. Strangelove, How I Came to Love the Bomb. I think it's Dr. Strangelove that has the line, although I might be mixing it up with a Fireside Theater skit where somebody says, you know, who's going to tell the American people? Or it might have even been Woodward and Bernstein. But here's the question. Who's going to tell the American people? Do they even want to know? Here's another example. The House of Representatives right now is controlled by the Republicans. John Boehner is the Speaker of the House. Nationwide, Democrats got 1.5 million more votes than Republicans did for members of the House of Representatives. How is it that the Republicans are running the House? Well, back in 2006, 2008, a group of billionaires started funding Republican efforts to take over traditionally blue states, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Virginia, Indiana, Wisconsin, so that they could gerrymander those states and arguably John Boehner and the House of Representatives are there through fraud. I just find this all amazing. Jake in Las Vegas, Nevada. Hey, Jake. Some thoughts on this?
Hey, Tom. How you doing? All right?
Yeah, I'm fine. I'm just astounded that this is not, here's the president of Iran comes out and says, I was elected. 96% of the vote in the Iranian election in 1980 went to free the hostages candidates. Only 4% went to keep the hostages candidates, and yet we didn't free the hostages because the Ayatollah had cut a deal with the Reagan for President campaign. He comes right out and says it. It gets published in the Christian Science Monitor, which does not publish nonsense. They double and triple check their things. And no national media in the United States picked this story up. Back to you, Jake.
I want to get your opinion on why you think President Johnson would not have exposed Nixon to his treasonous behavior rather than let him become president. It seems to me it's much worse that he did become president rather than expose him to the American public .
Well, I think there were two dimensions to this. The first was that I'm guessing LBJ could not have played the CIA tapes. That would be a breach of national security, particularly during a campaign. And so he would have been in a situation of calling a press conference saying, I know that Richard Nixon is doing something, but I can't tell you. I can't prove it to you. So, just saying to the American people. I mean, Everett Dirksen had a security clearance, but you and I don't, right? So, first of all, he couldn't lay the whole thing out. And then secondly, it would have shocked the American people. I think Lyndon Johnson genuinely wanted the American people, and this is clip number six, Shana, genuinely wanted the American people to believe that their elections have integrity. I think this is the reason why Democrats don't want to talk about voting machines. But here's the tape. This is Lyndon Johnson talking to Everett Dirksen, just answering your question, Jake. Why didn't he expose Nixon? Here he is.
And I'm calling you only after talking to Rusk and Clifford and all of them.
Pause that for a second.
Thought that somebody...
Dean Rusk was, as I recall, the Secretary of Defense, and Clark Clifford, as I recall, was the Secretary of State at the time. So let's play that one more time.
Somebody ought to be notified as to what's happening. Now, I can identify them because I know who's doing this. I don't want to identify it. I think it would shock America if a principal candidate was playing with a source like this on a matter this important.
Yeah.
I don't want to do that. But if they're going to put this kind of stuff out, they ought to know that we know what they're doing. I know who they're talking to, and I know what they're saying.
So you get it, Jake? LBJ was genuinely thinking about the American, he didn't want the Republic to fall. I think he genuinely felt that if people thought that their candidates for president were criminals, or at least one of them, or one was accusing the other of being a criminal, that the confidence would be so badly shaken, it would be a bad thing for America. Jake, thanks for the call. I disagree with Johnson in retrospect, but it must have been a hard call to make.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I mean, this is like an episode of Scandal, a TV show, I mean, at what point do you say, yes, the president of the United States is not was fraudulently elected? Welcome back. One of our callers today is going to receive a free autographed copy of my book, The Tom Hartman Reader, collection of my writings going back some decades. Free signed copy of my book will be sent using stamps.com, by the way. That caller could be you. Virginia in Seattle. Hey, Virginia, what's up?
Hi. Well, if all these people are getting in with illegal methods, shouldn't they be in jail? And also, shouldn't these things that they've put into being into law be illegal and canceled?
Yes. In my opinion, Catherine Harris should have gone to jail. Jeb Bush should have gone to jail. President Bush's presidency should have, he should have been impeached. It should have been declared null and void by Congress. There's no political will for this, though, Virginia. Everybody's, you know, it's a get along.
We inspire people.
Yeah, well, it's a get along, go along, and that needs to come to an end. But it's not going to come to an end until the media starts telling the truth about these things, and they're not. And that's the real tragedy. Virginia, thank you for the call. Victor in Winfield, West Virginia. Hey, Victor.
Good afternoon, Tom. First time caller. I'm referring to H.W. Bush.
Right.
He was the head of NSA, and I kind of found it really ironic that he was a war hawk and he was out of the loop on the Iran-Contra affair.
Right. Yeah, if you believe that Herbert Walker Bush was out of the loop on Iran-Contra, then I got a bridge to sell you, you know, in the middle of the Atlantic. I mean, it's like...
Reagan was out of the loop.
Yeah, right. Well, Reagan, you know, actually a friend of mine was in the room when Reagan was deposed on Iran-Contra. And in the last year of his presidency, and he said, I don't remember 168 times. And I think he genuinely didn't remember, because I believe that during the last year or two of his presidency, his Alzheimer's had, you know, it was biting him in the butt. He was just in la-la land, and George Herbert Walker Bush was basically running the country. And, you know, another one of those, who will tell the American people? But, if you didn't think that George Herbert Walker Bush knew, when the guy who Ronald Reagan when his campaign manager pulled this thing off with the Iranians, with the Ayatollahs, he made his campaign manager, Bill Casey, the head of the CIA. And thanks for the call, Victor. And so here's Bill Casey, the head of the CIA. George Herbert Walker Bush used to be head of the CIA. He maintained his connections at the CIA. He had been a CIA operative or officer for decades. And when the Iran-Contra, when Congress was investigating, Milton Gould, who was Bill Casey's lawyer, and Barbara Honegger has this in her book, October Surprise, Milton Gould said after Casey died, he said Bill Casey was going to go before Congress and tell the truth. He was going to spill the beans. So what happened? The morning that he was supposed to go in to testify before Congress, here he is sitting in his office as director of the CIA, head guy at the CIA. The morning he was supposed to go in and testify before Congress, he has a seizure, falls on the floor. They take him off to the Bethesda Naval Hospital. They cut open his skull, and they remove the left parietal region, which is, you know, right over the ear, the left part. That's basically where Gabby Giffords was shot. They rendered him speechless. They cut his tongue out. He died about 8 weeks later as a result of complications of the surgery. So Bill Casey had been prepared to betray Ronald Reagan and George Herbert Walker Bush, and they took him out. Danelle, or is it Danette in Huntsville, Georgia?
It's Danette, Tom.
Hey,
Danette. Hi. Hey. Hi. I was thinking that in the same way that the TV show 24 made it more plausible for an African American to be president, I think the TV show Scandal is going to make it more realistic that corruption occurs at the highest level of government.
Yeah, because that show, there's a conspiracy to rig the voting machines in, Defiance, Ohio?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes, it's in Defiance, Ohio. So I really think that the more that stuff like that is shown, not just like in movies, but in TV shows where people follow it and they really, because I watch it every week and I read the comments that are done on Facebook, and you know, there's a lot of conversation about that.
Yeah, we're talking about the 2004 election in Ohio. I mean, that 2004 election, Bush stole that election in Ohio, or actually Karl Rove did. Why is it that the vote totals for the state of Ohio had to be run through a computer in Kentucky that was owned by a guy who worked for Karl Rove? And then sent back to Ken Blackwell, who was the Secretary of State in Ohio, who is also the chairman of the Bush for Reelection Committee in Ohio. And, you know, I believe in the 2004 election that Bush stole that election, too. But good point to that. Thank you for calling and making it. Kent in Salt Lake City, Utah. Hey, Kent.
Yeah, hi. Yeah, hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. And I enjoy your show, and I am outraged when you're talking about.
But you want to talk about 1960.
Yeah, that's right, about 1960. I'm afraid that there's going to be a false equivalence made by the media that, you know, that you're just a mirror image of Fox News if you don't address that, because, you know, Daley's accused of of stealing the election for Kennedy by right. having all these dead people vote.
Yeah, well, there's been a couple of different stories out of Chicago. One was Daley had dead people vote. Another was that Daley had the mechanical voting machines rigged and then dumped them in the Chicago River. Both of those stories have been pretty thoroughly debunked, but here's where it really gets interesting. If Chicago had not voted for Kennedy, Kennedy would have still won. It was Lyndon Johnson basically being the senator from Texas all those years that took Texas, and it was the electoral votes in Texas that won the election for Kennedy. Kennedy could have lost the city of Chicago and still carried Illinois. So, you know, I've heard that many times. My dad used to mutter about that a lot, being a good Republican, but it didn't matter. It's just it didn't matter. Richard in Victorville, California, got just a half a minute here. Richard, a very quick comment.
Hey, Tom, how you doing today?
Good.
You know, my thing is this whole situation with Johnson with the tapes about Nixon, and, you know, it seems like as progressives and Democrats, our politicians don't seem to learn. Every chance that the Republicans get, they're going to throw us under the bus.
Yeah.
This whole idea that we've got to play nice guy while they're doing everything they can to win, no matter by hook or crook. You know, it's like in a fight out on the street. You know, you can't keep gloves on while the other guy is punching you in the jaw and you just keep turning the other cheek.
Yeah, I don't disagree, Richard. Although I don't think that the answer is for us to start stealing elections, I do think that the answer is to start outing these guys for what they've done, which I'm starting on this show today, although we have talked about this in the past. We will be back. We're going to talk to Peter Ferrara about Keynesian economics. This should be entertaining. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to the second hour of our program. In the third hour of our program, Congressman Peter DeFazio is dropping by. Right now, we have with us Peter Ferrara. Today's our Peter Day. Peter is the senior fellow with the Carlson Center for Public Policy, the CCCP.org, the website. Wasn't that the acronym of the Soviet Union?
No, the Soviet Union had three C's in it. We only have two.
So you're CCPP.
Yes.
Okay, I've got a typo in what I'm looking at here. Thank you, Peter, for correcting that. You wrote a piece called Hartman, this isn't Hartman versus Ferrara. The piece is on a different page. Apparently, I don't have the piece in my show notes.
It's called The Coming Sequester Lies.
Yeah, here we go, The Coming Sequester Lies. And I read that this morning. And you want to give us a summary of it?
Well, I mean, one thing to draw out of the sequester debate is that the Democrats don't want to make any spending cuts. I mean, here you have just a 1% reduction of federal spending, not from current level of spending, but from the increase. So you're just reducing federal spending by 1% from the increase. It's still going to increase several percent this year, and they're telling us it's the end of the world. So what that tells you is they're not going to agree to any spending cuts voluntarily unless we trap them into it like we did with the sequester. And the second thing is their economic policy, which is spending cuts hurt the economy and tax increases don't. The Senate was considering an alternative to the sequester. The Democrats were pushing an alternative to the sequester that would increase the capital gains taxes again for the third time. And we're only in March, and it's a third tax increase on capital gains, which would make it the fourth highest capital gains tax rate in the entire world, to go with the highest corporate tax rate in the entire world, except for the socialist one-party state of Cameroon, which still manages to nose us out. And so that would leave us very anti-competitive, but it's very upside-down notion. Cutting spending is good for the economy. It's pro-growth. And raising taxes, of course, even John Maynard Keynes said, is negative for the economy.
Let's qualify that. John Maynard Keynes said raising taxes on working people was bad for the economy. I don't see how raising taxes on Mitt Romney and Paris Hilton, on people who earn their living sitting on their butts around the pool waiting for the dividend checks to arrive, is going to hurt the economy. And I also, in your article, you said, indeed, the entire Keynesian focus on demand is misconceived because demand is insatiable and can never be adequate in a market economy. I'm assuming you've read enough Keynes to understand that when he says demand, he's talking about money being spent into an economy.
Yeah, actually, I learned my Keynes at Harvard, where they actually were the real inventors of Keynesian economics.
Right. So why would you say this? Why would you say that demand is insatiable?
I'm disputing the whole doctrine of Keynesian economics. The economy does not run on spending more. It runs on increased production, not increased spending. So the whole notion is fallacious. If demand is inadequate for any good or service, the price simply declines until supply equals demand. And so the whole thing is silliness, and it only survives as a doctrine because it justifies what leftists want to do, which is increase spending and increased spending and deficit.
Well, I think what you're describing is a good description, actually, of the process of inflation. If there is a commodity which is an essential commodity, for example, oil, and suddenly there's less of that commodity, as there was during the Carter administration and during the Nixon administration, the two times that the Arabs cut us off, then suddenly there's an increase in demand for that, and the price goes up. Demand chases the price up because the supply is not adequate. So I'll give you that. That's a great way to explain the mechanism of inflation. But I don't see what that has to do with an orderly economy. Are you saying that this demand-side stuff that Reagan peddled to us, that if billionaires build more factories, we will suddenly want to buy more goods, that's how we should be looking at the economy?
It's production that it drives prosperity and growth. You can't spend yourself rich. And so that should be obvious, and it's silliness.
Why not?
Another one.
What got us out of the Great Depression, Peter?
You want to spend yourself rich by tomorrow. I'm sure there's lots of stuff you'd want to buy.
What got us out of the Great Depression?
You know, because rich people do spend a lot of money. So, Tom, go spend yourself rich by tomorrow, and
you'll be a billionaire. What got us out of the Great Depression, Peter?
Well, what got us out of the Great Depression? The World War II got us out of the Great Depression.
Okay, so that was the largest government spending program in the history of the world.
Spending does zero to promote the economy.
What got us out of the Great Depression?
It's anti-growth. It's anti-growth because...
We did not cut spending during World War II. We radically increased spending.
Yeah, because actually, yeah, that really is... I shouldn't have said that because really that's a fallacy. World War II did not get us out of the Depression.
No, Franklin Roosevelt got us out of the Depression.
The economy was in the Depression for long enough. I mean, how long was it supposed to be before it recovers? That never lasted that long before. It was only because they pursued the Obamanomics one that it lasted as long as it did.
FDR had gotten unemployment from over 30% down to the mid-teens by 1936.
It would have
3 years.
Following your advice. It would have ended in 1929 if they hadn't been following your advice.
No, 29 was the result of 3 years of supply-side economics. For 3 years, Herbert Hoover had been saying, we'll just wait for the billionaires to bail us out. And it just got worse and worse and worse. Can you give me an example of a time when supply-side economics went saying, okay, we're going to cut taxes on the rich, and this is going to produce a lasting prosperity? Any time in the history of America when it's actually worked?
1960s, Kennedy did it, and the economy boomed.
Kennedy actually raised taxes on the rich.
Why are you interrupting me? And they ended up with more.
Because you're not telling the truth.
Rather than less.
You know that Kennedy raised taxes on the rich, Peter. And in fact, I've heard conservatives brag about the fact that when Kennedy, and it wasn't Kennedy, by the way, it was Lyndon Johnson. It was after Kennedy was assassinated.
Yeah,
Kennedy called for it.
That raised taxes. Kennedy cut taxes, but it was 91% rate. He cut it to the 70% rate. Let me remind you.
It was Johnson who did it. It was after Kennedy died.
Cut the 91% rate to the 70% rate, and the economy boomed, and revenues went up rather than down.
And Kennedy made it very clear, and I suggest you go back and listen to his debate with Richard Nixon in 1960.
We quote it all the time here on the supply side.
Yeah, okay.
All the time. It was early supply side economics, in fact.
Well, it was not. What Kennedy said was that he was going to close the loopholes, and that was going to generate more revenue. He's going to drop the rate because nobody was paying that 91% rate. Kennedy should know. He was a rich guy. Nobody was paying that because the thing was drilled full of loopholes. So he closed the loopholes, dropped the rate to 74%, and rich people ended up actually paying more in taxes after 1964 when Lyndon Johnson did that so-called tax cut. It was actually a tax increase on the very wealthy. People paid more in taxes. Rich people paid more in taxes. You know that.
He cut the tax rates for everybody, and he cut the top rate from 91 to 70. There was no
74%.
Loophole closing, and the revenue soared. because the economy boomed, and the exact same thing happened under Reagan. And so we created the 25-year economic boom from 1970.
Then why did Reagan raise the top tax rate back up from the 28% that he'd taken it down to?
He didn't raise it. Reagan did not raise it. When Reagan left office, it was 28%. He took it down from 70% when he entered office all the way down to 28%.
In the last year.
25-year economic boom.
Okay, so it was George Herbert Walker Bush who raised it.
Boom in world history, 1982 to 2007.
Yeah, okay. So if you want to, I was there. I remember the 80s as the largest stock market crash we had had since 1929. It was 86. I remember the savings and loan collapse. I remember the two Reagan recessions. You look at the 80s in aggregate, and during that decade, GDP growth was not over 3%. It was just a little under 3%, whereas the 70s, the 60s, and the 50s had all been over 3%. I guess we remember it differently, but I'm still baffled by...
I was in the Reagan White House at the time, so yes, I was very much there, and I saw it firsthand, and that stock...
What you were seeing was a bubble.
Was a blip.
You were seeing a bubble. When you cut the top tax rate below 50%, you create a bubble.
No, you create incentives for increased production, which is exactly what happened. The greatest period of production in world history. More wealth was created from 1982 to 2007 than at all prior American history combined.
Well, you know, I would say that, you know, anybody who's running a Ponzi scheme would say the same thing. It was a bubble. But anyway, Peter Ferrara, theccpp.org is the website. Thank you, Peter.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back 15 minutes past the hour. It's amazing. There's still supply-siders out there, and they still believe this stuff. It's incredible. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Dean in Littleton, Colorado, listening on AM 760. Hey, Dean, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I'm a young engineer, just recently got into politics, you could say. What I don't get is why people can't seem to agree on many of the basics. For example, the Great Depression.
Right.
You had the stock market crash, and then things got steadily better after there. Well, you get one side saying, oh, it would have gotten better much quicker if, you know, we follow these policies. And then other people say, well, no, it did get faster. Why is it that people can't, I guess, objectively figure out why something happened and not let it happen again?
Well, until the last decade.
I really don't get it.
In large part because all the people who were there are dead. So, you know, the memory is gone. And over the last 10, 15, 20 years, there have been a whole bunch of these right-wing think tanks who have been trying to reinvent history. The fact of the matter is that the economy had been, you know, growing slowly but steadily up until 1920. We were post-World War I at that point. Warren Harding ran for president in the election of 1920 on the campaign platform of less government in business, more business in government. He came into office in 1921. He dropped the top tax rate from 90% down to 25%. Sound familiar? And kicked off the bubble of what was referred to as the Roaring Twenties. The price of property tripled, quadrupled, quintupled in many parts of the country. There was this huge housing boom. The stock market went through the roof. It was a classic bubble. And after the Harding presidency came the Republican Coolidge presidency, Silent Cal. He didn't do much of anything. He just called it the Coolidge prosperity. Just let that bubble grow. I mean, what we're looking at here is basically, you know, Reagan followed by Clinton, followed by Bush. Just let that bubble grow. And then after the Coolidge presidency came Herbert Hoover. And Herbert Hoover won the election in 1928. He was inaugurated in March of 1929. And by then, as he was inaugurated, the housing market was already collapsing around him. And by October of 29, it spread to the stock market. The stock market crashed. So and if you go back and you look, what the stock market did basically is it crashed back down to where it was in 1920. In other words, all the air went out of the bubble. But you know, in the meantime, the economy had been reshaped over those previous, you know, 9 years to accommodate itself to the bubble. And so, you know, a lot of people lost their job. You had 30% unemployment. You had a real disaster. And here we actually had an example. Herbert Hoover, as president of the United States, pursued the same policies that Republicans today are suggesting. He cut spending. He tried to balance the budget. He did not, you know, try to spend our way into prosperity, try to cut our way into prosperity. And what happened? We went from 5% unemployment to 8% unemployment to 12% unemployment to 15% unemployment to 19% to 20% to 24% to 26% to 28% to 30% to 31% to 33%. And that's when Franklin Roosevelt ran for president, was sworn in 1932, won the election November 32, was sworn in March of 1933. And the week that Franklin Roosevelt was sworn in, the last of all the banks in the United States failed. It was the depths of the Great Depression. After 3 years of the Republicans controlling the House, the Senate, and the White House, and doing what they are recommending right now, the kind of things that Peter Ferrara was recommending, basically Reaganomics, let's just do this. Let's go back to what Warren Harding did. Let's cut taxes on rich people, which Herbert Hoover did, you know, maintain those tax rates low, and let's just hope that the rich are going to bail us out. Franklin Roosevelt came in, raised those taxes back up to 91%, and started and took that money and put people back to work. And he comes into office in 33 with an unemployment rate of 33%. By 1934, he's got the unemployment rate down in the 20s. By 1935, he's got it in the low 20s. By 1936, he's got it down into the mid-teens. That's a radical change. I mean, a dramatic change. I think it got down to like 13 or 14%. And then in 37, he dialed back because the election in 1936, the big issue became his deficit spending. So he bowed to the Republicans in 37 for about a year and dialed back on the New Deal. And what did it do? It threw us back into recession. Although by that point, we were out of the Great Depression.
So how do you refute the claims? What I always hear is, you know, look at they claim that some of these smaller recessions between the Great Depression and now, they claim that the initial collapse was just as bad, but it's the recovery that was so much better in the 80s. I think there was another one, another small recession, and they claim it's because of those same policies.
Some of the stock market crashes were bad. I mean, the stock market crash during Reagan was the worst one since 1929. And then, you know, we didn't have another one that was that bad until 2008. So, you know, all by coincidence during Republican administrations. But that didn't mean that big stock market crash during Reagan, that didn't mean that there was a Great Depression. What it meant was there was a really bad year for the stock market. So it was a way of harvesting money out of the stock market, you know, rich people harvesting middle class money, in my opinion, out of the stock market.
So the idea that a recession like that was just as bad as the Great Depression
or the one
we had in 2007 is simply untrue.
We have never hit 30% unemployment in the United States since 1929. Or since the era of 1929 to 1933. We have not come even close to it. We would have, you know, when Obama came into office and we were losing 700,000 jobs a month during the last 4 months of the Bush administration. And we had lost over 4 million, I think almost 5 million jobs during the last, you know, half a year of the Bush administration. Had Obama done what the Republicans said, which is just keep on, you know, basically do what Herbert Hoover did, just don't do anything. You know, yeah, we might be at 30% unemployment right now. But instead, Obama started doing what Franklin Roosevelt had done. And then, you know, Roosevelt during 37, he dialed back his spending on the New Deal. He cut back on the WPA and the CCC and some other projects. And unemployment started going back up again. And it went up back up into the high teens. And people freaked out. And, you know, by 38, 39, he started spending again. And then by 41, we were in World War II. And then we were spending, you know, he opened the spigot full bore, just poured money into the economy, and it got us, you know, we went to full employment. Unemployment rate went to zero functionally. And, you know, now that's a lousy way to get out of a depression, you know, is with a war. But the fact of the matter is it was government spending. It was not, you know, General Electric coming along and saying, we'll save you. Yeah, we tried that. It didn't work. Dean, thank you very much for the call. We'll be back. It's 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So why would it be that there are still people running around saying, oh, you know, spending didn't get us out of the Great Depression. You know, somebody created a factory someplace. Well, probably because they're paid to. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And very, very interesting. Devin in White Lake, Michigan. Hey, Devin, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good.
I was actually calling because we produced our way out of the Great Depression. We did not spend our way out. And the fact is, yeah, we during World War II.
So where did people get money to buy all that production?
Well, you spend your way out. The government, of course, everybody's going to spend for the war effort. After the war effort, if we didn't bomb the rest of the world into rubble, our industrial base wasn't touched. They had to come somewhere to buy what they needed, cranes, bulldozers. So they came to the U.S. because our industrial base was not touched.
No, they didn't. If you look at U.S. exports, look at U.S. trade as a percentage of GDP, and you'll see that after World War I, it went up 1%. We did not, what recovered the U.S. economy was not our selling things to devastated Europe. In fact, what we did is we gave Europe enough money that they could rebuild their own factories. And
let's face it, they had to buy bulldozers from somewhere.
Well, there were lots of countries around the world that were making bulldozers, and there were a lot of bulldozers still left intact all over Europe. They were not buying them from us, or if they were, it was in such small numbers that it didn't affect our GDP numbers. What affected our GDP numbers was that the Eisenhower administration was paying half of the cost of all new hospitals, and then local communities paid all the other half, because all hospitals back then were nonprofit, community owned. They were paying 80% of the cost of new schools into communities across the United States. They bragged about this in the 1956 Republican platform when Dwight Eisenhower was running for re-election.
Even the industrials of the day back then, reading their interviews, I remember the one with Henry Ford, and he came straight out. He said the minute the Depression ended was when FDR died, because all the uncertainty in the marketplace was gone.
Oh, Henry Ford was a right-wing crank. Henry Ford also thought that Hitler was a fine guy. He thought that Jews were an inferior species. He published newspapers to that effect.
There was a lot of industrials that believed that same thing, that when FDR died, the uncertainty in the marketplace was gone.
When FDR died, the Great Depression was gone. It was gone long before FDR died.
The uncertainty was gone, and as far as...
It had nothing to do with uncertainty. Devin, are you trying to tell me you believe in the uncertainty theory?
If the government brings in, like what's going on now, well, we got all these regulations coming in. You got cost of compliance. You have this going on. You have that going on.
None of that's uncertain. If I'm building a coal-fired power plant and I know that I've got to put a scrubber on it because the regulations are there, I'm going to have to create a few extra jobs to put in that scrubber. Regulations actually have been demonstrated to increase employment, not to decrease it.
But next week, you have a different regulation.
Well, of course we move forward, Devin. You know, recycled Republican talking points are not going to convince anybody. You know, everybody knows that this stuff is nonsense. For example, seatbelts. You Republicans and conservatives are saying, oh my God, if we have to have seatbelts, it's going to kill the auto industry. But, you know, Lyndon Johnson passed the law anyway. In fact, it might have been later than Johnson. Might have been Nixon. But the law got passed anyway, and we got seatbelts, and what happened? The auto industry figured out a way to make money off it. Airbags. Oh, we can't have airbags. It'll kill you. You know, these regulations, they're killing us. Airbags worked out pretty good. We had decreased deaths, thus more productivity. I defy you to find a time point to regulations that are actually hurting the economy, Devin. You can't do it. That's why these guys always talk about them in the abstract. If there were regulations that were actually hurting the economy, they would be pointing to them.
You're also talking about big business.
No, name one, please.
These type of things.
One regulation.
GE can absorb
one regulation.
Type of regulation you throw at them.
One regulation that you would like to get rid of.
A lot of the regulations.
Just name one.
A lot of the regulations on these coal-fired power plants.
Okay, so you think that coal-fired power plants should be able to put as much poison into the air as they want? Is that what you're saying?
If you powderize the coal and you throw the coal in there as a powder, it burns just as clean as natural gas.
No, that's nonsense. If that was true, and you have a regulation that says you have to have clean emissions from your smokestack, the regulation becomes irrelevant because industry can get around it by pulverizing the coal. So either A, it's not true, in which case you have to have the regulation unless you want a lot of people to die of cancer and neurological diseases and a lot more mercury in the air, or B, it is true, and the regulation is irrelevant. So the only regulation you can come up with is coal-fired is making the air coming out of coal-fired power plants cleaner. That's pretty weak, Devin. That is actually one of the few that has been demonstrated to increase jobs. Somebody has to build those scrubbers.
Well, yeah. Well, you also have a lot of these greenhouse gases that 95% are naturally occurring. So how are we going to stop those?
What is naturally occurring about the carbon dioxide coming out of a coal-fired power plant?
NASA has come up with one of their reports they came up with, 95% of the carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide that is put into the atmosphere is naturally occurring. We just had a volcano erupting over there. Was it Sicily?
Devin, I hate to break it to you, but you're wrong.
So
you're sadly wrong. Carbon dioxide, exhale carbon dioxide. Cows fart methane. I get all that. Trees inhale carbon dioxide. They exhale oxygen. There is a natural cycle there. But when you take hundreds of millions of years worth of carbon that had been sequestered in the earth for 600 million years in the form of coal and oil and natural gas, and you burn in 1 year 100 million years worth of carbon sucked out of the atmosphere, you are going to see a change. And if you look, Devin, just go back and look at any scientist, even the climate deniers, look at the levels of CO2 in the atmosphere over the last 100 years, and you will see this incredible spike.
When a volcano erupts, even with NASA and the scientists, if that volcano in Sicily is putting out 100 years worth of our carbon dioxide output.
No. Not true. I hate to break this to you.
I'm not.
There was a whole industry during the tobacco times that of these phony scientists who were coming out and saying, "Oh, we can't say that tobacco causes cancer, and you can't say that that person's cancer came from that pack of cigarettes," and when it's all uncertain, and you know, tobacco might even be good for you. What was his name? The actor that they hired, he eventually died of lung cancer. To be a front man for Morton Downey Jr. Morton Downey. They hired him as a front man, and he headed the National Smokers Alliance, I think it was called. And those guys, you know, I mean, they all went down in flames in the 80s or 90s, and those same scientists in many cases, and certainly the same organizations, have been resurrected with hundreds of millions of dollars in the fossil fuel industry to say the kind of things that you're saying. And they're just not true, Devin. They're just not true. You know, either you're working for them and getting paid to call into this show, or you have, you know, and tragically, sadly, been reading websites or listening to people who are making money off this industry. And you're going to discover...
Making money off of NASA?
This has got nothing
NASA
to do with NASA.
Come out with the carbon monoxide.
Okay, if you want to know NASA's thoughts on this, I encourage you to read James Hansen, one of NASA's top scientists, James Hansen, who says if we don't get our carbon dioxide emissions below 350 parts per million, and they're all the way up to 390 right now, we will create a plan that is not the one to which humans are adapted and in which we evolved.
Look at the scientists from East Anglia University that have come out going, yeah.
Devin, this is the classic tobacco thing. You got a couple of scientists arguing with each other over some very, very minute and small point, and it's mostly about their egos, and then you selectively release some of their emails. There's nothing that came out of East Anglia that knocks down any of this science. Absolutely nothing. And if you believe that there is, I'm telling you, Devin, you are reading the websites or listening to people who are the paid shills. This industry has literally $1 trillion or more worth of money in the ground in the form of oil and coal that they have staked the rights to. And they are, by God, going to get that money out of the ground. And they will spend, and they have already spent, hundreds of millions of dollars to convince people like you that it's just fine if they do that and it'll have no consequence. And, Hurricane Sandy, that was just an anomaly. And these mile-wide tornadoes coming across the Midwest, it's just, you know, stuff happens. It's like they used to say, that cancer, that person probably would have gotten cancer whether they smoked or not. It is the exact same industry, the exact same people, and the exact same kind of argument, and they're getting, you know, gullible, well-intentioned people like you, Devin, to buy their argument. It's really tragic when you can look at the actual science and see that this is, you know, we are facing a serious crisis here in this world. And to say, those scientists, they want to make money. That's why they're saying this, right? You've heard, I'm guessing you've got that argument, Devin?
The Northeast has been hit by hurricanes before.
Why are these scientists saying this?
They're tracking historical.
Why are the scientists? Why are 98% of the scientists in the world saying that we are facing a climate crisis?
Because 98% aren't. The 98% that are funded by people like Al Gore, those people, yeah.
Okay. So you know how much money Al Gore has?
You got a definite.
Nothing compared to what ExxonMobil has. And ExxonMobil has spent millions in funding climate deniers. This is what it all gets down to. These guys are accusing others of doing exactly what they're doing. Just like the tobacco industry used to say, oh, those government scientists who are saying the tobacco causes cancer, they're just trying to get some more research money. Right. I'm telling you, Devin, the oil industry and the coal industry and the gas industry is sitting on trillions of dollars. They're going to get it come hell or high water.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And what they and their handmaidens on the right, the right-wing talk show hosts, the right-wing websites, what they're doing is they're turning so many good people into useful idiots. Welcome back to Talk Media for the sane among us, the Tom Hartman Program, and goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Brings us the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, where you can give a goat to help a rescued slave and get a photo of your goat and the person you helped. Victoria Jones. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So what's up today?
Well, some interesting stories today. We've talked about the sequester extensively, and I thought we'd touch on some other important things that are going on.
Okay.
Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel is reviewing a lieutenant general's decision to overturn a guilty verdict in a sexual assault case. And this is an interesting sexual assault case of a very high-profile Lieutenant Colonel James Wilkerson, who was found guilty by an all-male jury in Italy. He's a fighter pilot, considered a superstar, and he's decided to review this decision because the Lieutenant General just reviewed it, threw it out, didn't give a reason, which he's not required to do. The guy's back in the Air Force. And this has caused absolute outrage for a number of reasons, including the fact that the Air Force has been grappling for the past year with an even bigger scandal in which basic training instructors have been charged with raping and assaulting dozens of female recruits at Lackland Air Force Base in Texas. And Air Force leaders have described sexual misconduct as a cancer in the ranks that the service is struggling to combat.
Hmm. Interesting.
So Hagel wrote in a letter to Senators Barbara Boxer and Jean Shaheen that he's told the Air Force Secretary and Pentagon lawyers to review the case.
That's good.
Now, the thing is, he doesn't have the authority to overturn the decision by Lieutenant General Craig Franklin.
Right.
He has absolute authority.
Okay.
As the commander.
So so there's nothing that can be done?
No, he's the convening authority. He's a commander who is responsible for establishing a court-martial. Under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, a convening authority has sole discretion to reduce or set aside guilty verdicts and sentences or to reverse a jury.
So the he that you're talking about is the commander who already set aside this conviction, not
correct.
Chuck Hagel. So there is no Supreme Court within the Uniform Code of Military Justice within the military.
That's right. So Chuck Hagel can look at this, and he can recommend that the military now change its policy.
Right.
And he can also look at to see why he did this.
Right.
And see if there's anything that can be done. But basically, this guy can come in and can overturn a military court and jurors, all male jurors, who decided that this man was guilty of sexual assault and say, no, you're not. You can go.
Amazing. Amazing.
So it's very interesting. The Senate Armed Services Committee is holding a hearing on sexual assault in the military on Wednesday. The Wilkerson case is expected to be a major topic of discussion. They have not devoted a session to this subject in a decade.
Wow.
Yes. Yes. Democratic lawmakers, eight of them, are urging the president to declassify documents detailing the legal basis for his administration's use of drones, both against U.S. citizens and foreign nationals. John Conyers and Representative Barbara Lee are the two who have organized this. They wrote to President Obama today saying they're deeply concerned about legal claims in the leaked Justice Department white paper that appear to be overly broad.
Hmm. Now, speaking of John Conyers, he is he's circulating a piece of legislation called the Repeal the Filibuster Act. Any chance of that going anywhere?
You know, I would have said a couple of weeks ago no, but at this point, I think it could at some point. I think Harry Reid is probably moving more towards it, but I don't think he's ready to go there yet.
But John Conyers is in the House. This would have to make it past John Boehner.
Right, it would. So, but, you know, he's very senior. He's somebody who might be listened to.
Right. Huh. Interesting. Okay, good.
So it's interesting. So they're basically saying that, you know, we want to know how it's determined when capture of a terrorist suspect is feasible, how the term imminent threat is defined in a way that strays significantly from its traditional legal meaning.
Hmm. Okay.
Also today, a federal judge sounded skeptical of former Senator Larry Craig's claim that he properly used $217,000 in campaign funds for his legal defense after his arrest in a 2007 airport bathroom sex sting.
Right, for his wide stance.
For his wide stance and his tapping. Right. He says that the airport bathroom trip fell under his official duties as senator because he was traveling between Idaho and Washington for work. Therefore, the legal fees could be paid for with campaign money. But the district judge said that this reading could be taken to extremes. And she said, what if a lawmaker was arrested in the airport for robbing a kiosk or consorting with a prostitute?
So, now, isn't Larry Craig now working in Washington, D.C. as a lobbyist?
I believe he is.
Or working for a lobbying firm. Can you imagine if you go into a lobbying firm and say, hi, here's my $1 million, I want you to help me get this law changed, and they say, okay, cool, we're going to assign this guy to you, and you walk into the office and there's Larry Craig sitting there. I would be a little dismayed.
I think it would be awkward.
Yes. Okay, what else is going on?
I think it would be awkward. This sounds like a light story, but actually it's a big deal. A state judge today stopped Mayor Michael Bloomberg's administration from banning the sale of large sugary drinks at New York restaurants and other venues. This is a major defeat for Michael Bloomberg, who's made public health initiatives a cornerstone of his tenure.
So this is
due to come into effect tomorrow.
This is a state judge?
A state judge, New York Supreme Court Judge Milton Tingling.
So Judge Tingling says it is unconstitutional, or is he just does he have some other basis for striking it down?
He says that it's basically that the regulations are fraught with arbitrary and capricious consequences. He says that it's unenforceable even within a particularly city block, much less the city as a whole. The loopholes in this rule effectively defeat the state's purpose of the rule.
But he's not challenging the state's purpose of the rule.
Not as far as I've been able to see. It's the story's dribbling out. It's so new.
Yeah, very interesting. Okay, Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Great report. Fascinating. Congressman Peter DeFazio is going to be with us next. Saving Social Security from the Wall Street Hustlers.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Congressman Peter DeFazio is with us. Boy, it's been a while since we've talked with him. U.S. Congressman Peter DeFazio representing the 4th District of Oregon and my old stomping grounds and home state for 5 years. Congressman DeFazio, and his website, of course, defazio.house.gov. Congressman, welcome back.
Tom, yeah, I don't know what's been going on. Well, yeah, I mean, of course, you know, since we don't do anything in Washington anymore, you probably don't have much to talk to.
Well, anytime you got a news hook, let us know. I love talking with you.
All right.
And speaking of a news hook, apparently you and Bernie Sanders over in the Senate have introduced legislation to save Social Security. Do I have that right? Keep it away from the Wall Street hustlers?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, we fear that there's this sort of, you know, there's definitely a push going on to chain the CPI on Social Security. And if you look at the impact over a relatively short period of time, it would hit hardest at older seniors over time. And, you know, I mean, a lot of people outlive their savings, you know, and for the next generation of seniors, there aren't going to be very many pensions. And you become more and more dependent upon Social Security as you age. And the worst thing you can think of is, oh, well, let's lower their promised benefit in the future by using this phony economic assumption about, you know, qualitative substitution. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if people are trying to fix Social Security, that doesn't do it. It gives it one or two more years at the most before it would be theoretically not insolvent, but incapable of paying the benefits it promised, down to about 75%. So if you want to solve the problem, simple. Just do away with the tax loophole that allows wealthy people to pay a tiny fraction of their income in Social Security taxes. So we introduced our bill last week. We've introduced it before, and it would give 75-year solvency to Social Security.
And, which means forever, functionally.
Well,
they only go out
75
years.
Much beyond 75 years because, yeah, you know, that's sort of a normal lifespan. They don't know how many people will be here, what will happen, you know. So
sure,
you can't
sure
predict too far beyond that.
Yeah. So, Congressman DeFazio, why is it that, you know, people who make up to $113,000, 100% of their income gets hit with the Social Security tax, even if they're working at Walmart and you know, only making a couple thousand dollars a year, working part-time, you know, sharpening chainsaws or something, their income is 100% of their income is subject to Social Security tax. But if somebody, you know, Mitt Romney makes $20 million a year, and, you know, of that, of the first million, he's that might be called income, he's paying Social Security taxes on the first $113,000, and then after that, out of that $20 million, a $19,897,000, he doesn't pay a damn penny in Social Security tax. And in fact, on all of his capital gains income, him and Paris Hilton and all these other people who make their living sitting on their butts around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive, they don't pay a penny in Social Security tax. How'd they get that sweet deal?
Accident of history. I mean, the original earnings cap you know, was put in place when, you know, Social Security was enacted. It was adjusted from time to time by Congress, and then in 1977, when Social Security was having some big problems because of the high inflation and that, it was put on an automatic escalator on an annual basis, and it creeps up a little bit every year. You know, it's just an accident of history that, you know, we didn't assess the Social Security tax at a much smaller rate across a larger span of incomes. And,
right,
you know, that's the...
Well, it seems to me like this isn't even, you know, I've had Steve Forbes on this program a bunch of times, and he comes on and he goes, we got to have a flat tax. Have yep, the guy who's driving a bus pay the same as the billionaire, flat tax.
You got it. There was a guy named Archer, chaired Ways and Means last time the Republicans were in charge, and he was holding a hearing on tax possibility on Social Security. And I went there and I said, well, Mr. Chairman, you got to love my idea. I said, because you're for a flat tax, right? And he said, yeah. I said, okay, well, Mr. Chairman, here's an idea. Let's have a flat tax to pay for Social Security. And he kind of scratched his head. He's a little puzzled. And then he figured it out. He's like, oh, no. I said, well, I thought you were for a flat tax, but no, I guess not.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, exactly. They don't want the rich people to pay the flat tax. They just want everybody, you know, or working people, anybody making under $113,000.
Right. We just don't want to see Social Security as part of some big game, grand plan, whatever you call it, big deal.
Yeah.
Hoo-ha. If your concern is that Social Security, as an intergenerational program, will be there to pay promised benefits for the next 75 years, our plan's the way to get there.
Right. And Social Security, we should add, you know, a third of Social Security payments are not going to retired people. They're going to people like my friend Michael Hutchison, who broke his neck in his 30s, I think, and is quadriplegic.
Yeah, you've got a disability. You've got... minor children of deceased or disabled workers. You've got dependent spouses. Right. You know, there's a large number of other people who are collecting.
Literally widows.
Paul Ryan got education benefits because his parents died young.
Yeah, literally widows, orphans, and disabled people. And that's a, you know, so this, you know, you talk about Social Security, we're not just talking about a program that affects people over 65, you know, fully a third. And that's a lot of money and a lot of people. You know, millions and millions of people are affected by Social Security who are in their teens and their 20s and their 30s and their 40s and their 50s, and they've all got a dog in this game. I'm curious, you remember the House Progressive Caucus. The Progressive Caucus put forward the Balancing Act, a budget that would have balanced the budget in 10 years and done so in a fairly straightforward way. What's the fate of that right now?
Well, we haven't. We're going to see the Ryan budget tomorrow, I believe, mm-hmm. And then the budget committee will start marking up soon thereafter. We often try and offer alternatives from the Democratic side, the progressive version of the budget. Blue Dogs used to offer a budget. I don't know if there's enough of them left to put together a budget anymore. You know, with that, we're about to engage in that debate. First, you know, the opening salvo is tomorrow when we see how egregious Ryan's plan is. I mean, he's promising that he's going to balance the budget in 10 years with no new revenues. Now, let's think about it. There's a projected over $10 trillion deficit over the next 10 years. That would mean basically $1 trillion a year in cuts, which would mean eliminate the Pentagon and half of the general fund government, eliminate all general fund government and half the Pentagon, or is he going to target Social Security and Medicare and things like that? I mean, to get to that phenomenal number, he's going to have to do some serious damage.
Well, Social Security and Medicare.
No revenues.
Yeah, Social Security and Medicare are large programs. I smell Willie Sutton, you know, the famous bank robber. They asked him back in the 30s, why do you rob banks? And he says, because that's where the money is. I think that that's what Paul Ryan's going to do.
Well, remember, Social Security, with the exception of the Obama tax holiday, has never taken a penny of general fund money. So out of the $16-plus trillion of debt the United States has, only about $400 million of it is due to Social Security, and that was just over the last 2 years because of that tax holiday where the money was borrowed and put into the Social Security Trust Fund. But other than that, not one penny of that $16 trillion is due to Social Security.
It's amazing. It's amazing. And yet Pete Peterson has spent hundreds of millions of dollars of his own money trying to convince people that we should hand this off to Wall Street. Isn't that really what this is all about?
I think there's a couple of – there's an ideological agenda, and then there's the greed agenda. Sure, Wall Street, just think if you could manage – the retirement accounts of all Americans and just, you know, charge that monthly fee. Now, if you look at how much that would degrade people's Social Security benefits, let alone if they gambled and lost it. But, I mean, beyond that, just what that little fee, you know, you see the numbers add up tremendously over time, those little monthly fees.
Oh, yeah. The average person at retirement with a 401k, and 401ks have only been around 30 some odd years. The average person in retirement with a 401k has already spent more than $100,000 in fees. It's mind-boggling. Congressman Peter DeFazio, the website defazio.house.gov. Great talking with you, Congressman. Thank you.
Okay, have me back.
I will. Thanks for dropping by. Great talking with you. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. Supply-side economics. Presidents stealing elections. What's up next? Welcome back to the place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, I don't think so. One of our callers, by the way, today is going to receive a free signed copy of the Tom Hartman Reader, edited by Ty Moses. That's going to be sent out using stamps.com. And Zachary in Hampton, Georgia, you say the New Deal failed, really?
Yeah, actually, and I can prove it to you with a view on the fact that there actually had to be two New Deals, not just one. And the second New Deal was enacted in 1936, I believe, and Henry Morgenthau Jr. testified in front of Congress. I've got the exact quote right here. "We have tried spending money. We are spending more than we have ever spent before, and it does not work."
But it did.
I say after 8 years of this administration, we have just as much as unemployment as we had when we started.
But we didn't. He was wrong.
We
Go back and look at the statistics. I mean, you can find right-wing cranks who testify before Congress who say just about anything you want, Zachary. But the fact of the matter is that between 1933 and 1936, Franklin Roosevelt had dramatically cut unemployment. He had put millions of people back to work. The economy was starting to pick back up again. We were largely out of the Great Depression. And you know, it was working. It was working. And then you had these right-wingers going, oh, we can't be doing this. We've got to dial back on this. And tragically, Franklin Roosevelt listened to them. And in 37, he dialed back on spending on the New Deal, and it threw the country back into a recession.
Tom, who was Henry Morgenthau Jr.?
I don't recall. Was he the Secretary of the Treasury?
He was for FDR, I believe. So a right-wing crank.
Well, okay. So he's not a right-wing crank. But I challenge your assertion, and you know, I don't know the accuracy of your assertion of his assertion. I find it hard to believe that a member of Franklin Roosevelt's own cabinet would go before Congress and say what we're doing hasn't worked. I find that very hard to believe.
I would challenge you to research that. But secondly, if the New Deal was so successful, Charles Tansel actually wrote a book called Backdoor to War, in which it was the second, it was basically the second version of which he investigates State Department letters that were declassified, basically saying from 1933 to 1939, Roosevelt was doing everything he could to get us involved in war because he knew that wartime spending was the only thing that could correct the economy.
In other words, we needed more government spending, more government stimulus. I would say that Roosevelt was doing everything he could to get us involved in war after Hitler invaded Poland, because he was getting the reports about what was going on in the United States. Let me give you the exact numbers. Thank you, Shane. Shane just handed them to me. In 1925, the U.S. unemployment rate was at 8%. 1930, it was 8%. 1931, it was at 14%. 1932, it was at 25%. 1933, now this is the year that Franklin Roosevelt was sworn in, right? 1933, it was at 26%. 1934, the New Deal is kicking in. Unemployment's back down to 21%. 1935, unemployment's at 19%. 1936, unemployment is 17%. 1937, unemployment is at 14%. And then, as I said, in 1937, Roosevelt dialed back on the New Deal, and unemployment went back up to 20% in 1938. He started spending money again in 38. He said, oops, that was a mistake. And by 39, it was back down to 17%. And by 1940, it was at 14%. And 1941, the year that we entered the war, and that was December, so the year of 1941, you can't attribute to the war. By that time, unemployment was at 10%. You can't say the country's in a Great Depression when unemployment is at 10%. In fact, I don't think you can say the country's at a, which was 1941. I don't think you can say the country's in a Great Depression in 1937 when unemployment was at 14%.
I don't disagree, but the problem is that when they enacted the second New Deal, which actually didn't dial back the first one, it added on to the first, unemployment rose again. It didn't fall. And so
my point, this was Franklin Roosevelt modifying his policies to accommodate the Republicans and the deficit hawks. There was such a drumbeat for him to stop spending government money and stop indebting our people. And so he dialed back, and what happened? Unemployment went back up again. Zachary, good try, but, you know, just look at the numbers. Paul in South Lyon, Michigan. Hey, Paul, you're an economist?
Yeah, I'm an economist and a financial asset manager. But first, I wanted to say great show today.
Thank you.
And I'm glad we got the Republican right-winger solution to global warming, and that's all we got to do is plug up all the volcanoes.
Right, there you go. Yeah.
And think all the people that'll put to work.
Problem solved. You know, there actually is something to be said for that, but the last time that there was a serious volcanic activity that literally, you know, I mean, wiped out much of life on Earth, it was 250 years ago at the end of the Permian era.
Yeah.
So.
And we can't control that, but we can control air pollution.
Right.
But what I really want to talk about was, you know, economics. And the only way to get out of a recession is for the government to spend money to get, you know, to get out of the recessions. That one guy you had on said that spending money doesn't help an economy. That's like saying turning the heat on doesn't make a room warm. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Right. Well, not only that, he also was saying he was saying he was in the Reagan administration, Peter Ferrara, and they say Reagan was the ultimate Keynesian. Reagan borrowed $2 trillion. He took our national debt up to almost $3 trillion. Borrowed $2 trillion worth of money in 8 years, more money than any other president had ever borrowed. In fact, more money than most other presidents combined had borrowed, and spent it. And surprise, we had good times. I used to say back then, give me a credit card with $3 trillion on it, and I'll show you what it looks like to live large.
Yeah.
And that's what Reagan did. So.
But also, the way I like to explain it is, money circulating in an economy is like oil in an engine. If you let a few people, like the 1%, drain the oil out of the engine, what happens? It blows up. It seizes up.
Yeah.
So the way to get an economy going is to raise taxes on these so-called job creators who really aren't. They're just they're padding their own bank accounts.
No, I totally agree with you. And in fact, the metaphor that I use is cancer. You know, cancer sucks up all the blood, all the energy, all the nutrients in the body. And I'd say the 0.1% who are lobbying to keep things the way they are, they're cancer. Paul, hang on, Paul. You are the winner of the Tom Hartman Reader, autographed by me. Paul's on line 8. Paul Daniel.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And so Paul is going to win an autographed copy of the Tom Hartman Reader, autographed by me. That's my book. And sent by stamps.com. It's the good, the bad, and the very, very cacridocously ugly. The good. Paul Krugman. This is hysterical. The New York Times columnist smashed the myth of Social Security insolvency during his Sunday appearance on ABC's This Week when Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson urged his fellow panelists to take a hard look at the facts of government spending. Krugman interrupted to point out the senator's less than accurate understanding of reality.
My point. It made my point. We have got to agree on the facts.
But your facts are false.
So we have a problem.
They are not. They are not false.
The Social Security thing. Social Security if it has a dedicated revenue base, it has a trust fund based on that dedicated revenue base. You can't change the rules midstream and say, suddenly the trust fund doesn't count.
Here's the problem.
The right has co-opted the national dialogue surrounding quote entitlement spending. But here's the truth. Social Security is as well-funded a program as any. The mainstream media has succumbed to the chicken little rhetoric pushed by Senator Johnson and his corporate-backed buddies. So it's refreshing to see a pundit of Krugman's influence call the myth of Social Security's downfall what it is, a big fat lie. The bad. The Arkansas House of Representatives. The Arkansas House of Representatives decided against honoring one of our greatest ambassadors of democracy last week when it voted down a proposal to declare January 29th as Thomas Paine Day. According to State Representative Jody Dickinson, Paine's works are just too insulting to religion to justify a state Memorial Day. It seems that Representative Dickinson has a strange understanding of the word insulting, however. Arkansas celebrates Jefferson Davis Day every June 3rd. Right, because no one could possibly find a holiday honoring a reactionary defender of slavery and racism offensive. Unbelievable. And the very, very ugly, the right-wing Twitter sphere. The right-wing troll army showed its true colors this past week when it flooded Zerlina Maxwell's social media website pages with sexist and racist comments after her guest appearance on Sean Hannity's Fox News show. While on the air, Maxwell criticized Hannity's claims that arming women will prevent rape and pointed the dangers of trying to solve violence with more violence. Apparently, her logical response was just too much for the right-wing cyber hordes. One Twitter user called Maxwell a racial slur, and another told her that he hoped for her rape and murder. Another tweeted at Maxwell to tell her that she needed to be gang raped to get some common sense. After Maxwell bravely discussed her own rape with Hannity and another guest. Make no mistake about it, these trolls are the real right-wing masses, and that's just very, very ugly. Incredibly ugly. Eddie in Knoxville, Tennessee, you think that there's something just fine about Paris Hilton paying a maximum 20% income tax on the money she earns sitting on her butt around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive, but the plastic surgeon who works on her should pay 39%. Explain that to me.
Well, no. My thing is that it's not just millionaires and billionaires that live off of capital gains. My grandmother, my grandfather invested. That's where most of her money she comes to depend on comes from, is his investments over the years.
Do you? Okay, two factoids. Let me hang on just a second, Eddie. I'll let you talk as much as you want here, but just let me get two factoids on the table here. Number one, half of all stock owned in the United States is owned by the top 1%. The bottom 50% of Americans, which is, you know, includes a lot of retirees, more than 70% of retirees live on less than $15,000 a year. The bottom 50% of Americans own less than one half of 1% of all the stock in America. So, and stock is what kicks off capital gains in large part, number one. And number two, do you know what a graduated or a progressive tax is?
Yes.
Okay, see, and you know what a marginal tax rate is?
Yes.
Okay, so then you know that your grandmother, who's retired and living on dividends, probably is not paying any capital gains tax unless she's making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year.
That's true, but it still doesn't change the fact that...
Well, that radically changes the fact.
No, it doesn't, because there are still people who use those dividends for whatever reason. Why should they have to pay more? Just because
they don't. If they're low-income people, they don't pay.
Have to pay more if it affects other people. Your whole logic, and I've watched your show multiple times. Your whole logic is you sometimes have to hurt the privileged millionaires and billionaires to help everyone else.
No, that's not my logic.
It's not. It doesn't happen in a vacuum. There's not all things.
You are misrepresenting my logic.
You change everything.
You are misrepresenting my logic. First of all, please explain to me how it is. You know, the capital gains tax is progressive, just like the regular income tax, and it hits at the same income levels. So if your grandmother is making $15,000 or $20,000 a year, she's paying virtually nothing in capital gains tax. So why is it?
What if she's making $200,000 a year? I don't see why that makes her a bad person.
It doesn't. And her first $20,000 is still going to be tax-free. And her next $30,000, she's going to be paying 4 or 5%. And the next $20,000 or $50,000 after that, she's going to be paying 10% income tax. And when she hits the maximum, which I think is around $326,000, $330,000 a year, at that point, she will pay a maximum of 20% tax.
My question to you, Eddie, is why
should she pay a maximum 20% tax when somebody who's actually working for a living, rather than using money for a living, is paying a maximum 39% tax? What is it about people who earn their money using money that makes them so morally superior to you, that unless you live off money as well, unless you're a capitalist also, what is it that makes them so morally superior to you that you should be paying up to 39% income tax if you make over $320,000 a year, but they shouldn't?
Because my understanding from my college professors was that money that before they purchased the stock was taxed. That's double taxation. My question.
No, wait a second. No, you got your double taxation wrong. Here's the right wing argument. I'll give you the argument if you want to use it. The argument is that the corporation, before it declares a dividend, the dividend can only come out of after tax profits. So the corporation covers all their expenses, and then whatever's left over is profit. And so they declare that. Say the corporation has $1 billion left over in profit. They declare that profit. They pay $200 million of it in taxes. So now they have $800 million left over, and that $800 million that they have left over, they distribute as capital gains, or as dividends, rather. So that money has already income tax has already been taken out on that money. That's the conservative argument, okay?
Right.
So it's not that she had paid taxes on the money when she bought the stock, because, you could be that's true pretty much anything. I mean, why should I have to pay sales tax on a piece of furniture when the money that I used to buy that piece of furniture, I paid income tax on,
Right.
Given that, one quarter of all the profitable corporations in America pay no income taxes. So the double taxation isn't happening for a quarter of all the profit. And I'm talking about big corporations like ExxonMobil that declare huge dividends, pay no income taxes. You got $166 billion last year that got moved offshore just to avoid taxes. Those companies are still paying dividends. So that argument doesn't hold up. But even if that argument was true, even if it was true that the corporation paid income tax on that money and you're a stockholder and therefore you shouldn't have to pay income tax on that money, that doesn't make any sense to me. On our website, we sell Tom Hartman t-shirts and hoodies and, you know, swag, you know, that kind of stuff. If you've already paid taxes on your income tax and you buy some of my swag and I put that money in the checking account, the profit, the leftover money from that, should I not have to pay taxes on that?
Valid argument. Valid argument. I have one more question. What do you personally think the top marginal tax rate should be? Let's just say on income straight across the board.
Yeah. Well, first of all, it depends on where you set that top threshold. And
I'm just kind of curious.
I'd be glad to tell you. Larry Beinhart did some really good research on this, and I strongly suggest you look it up. And Larry Beinhart's actually a screenwriter, so it's not that hard to find. Beinhart, I think is how he spells his name. I've written a couple pieces on it. You put my name in the search engine, you'll find it too. And what he found was that whenever the top marginal tax rate on income over the equivalent in today's dollars of $1 million a year, okay, which is historically pretty much where it used to be. It wasn't $1 million, but, you know, because we've had inflation. Whenever the top marginal tax rate was above 50%, then we did not have economic busts and booms. We didn't have these wild cycles. And whenever the top income tax rate went below 50%, then we immediately entered into a period of busts and booms. And the reason why is because if you're making, you know, your first $1 million, you're paying less than 50% on that, you know, because it's graduated income tax. You look at that $1 million and you say, you know, when I hit that point, I'm going to be giving half my money to the government. Why bother hitting that point? And that's why up until Reagan in 1986, when he dropped the top marginal tax rate from 50% down to 28%, that's why up until 1986, average CEOs only made 30 times what their workers make. Today, they make 500 times what their workers make. So they're sucking all that money out. And that's hot money for them. I mean, it's easy money. They got that money very cheaply. And so they start gambling with that money, and that throws our economy into instability. So to give a direct answer to your question, I think the top marginal tax rate should be above 50% for income over $1 million to discourage people from taking that income and encourage them to keep their money in their business like they used to. Eddie, thanks a lot for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And in fact, you know, you look at the three decades of the biggest economic growth in the history of America, the 50s, 60s, and 70s, top tax rate was 91%. 10 minutes before the hour, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Mike, Fairfax, Virginia, wants to defend Paris Hilton's right to sit on her butt by the pool and earn her dividends. Hey, Mike, tell me why.
Well, you've already kind of talked a little bit about it, Tom. How are you doing? You know, before she spends that dollar, it's been taxed about six different ways, and we can debate whether that's right or wrong. But
well, hang on just a second. You get a paycheck, right?
I do.
Do you think that came from a tax-exempt entity?
No, it didn't.
Okay. I mean, none of us have a dollar. There's not a single dollar in your pocket that hasn't been taxed 16 different ways. It's the old W.C. Fields joke about water. You know, he says, never drink water. Fish screwing it, you know. It's like, you know, there's not a drop of water on Earth that hasn't been through somebody's kidneys. It's like, you know, similarly, there's not a dollar on Earth that hasn't been through somebody's taxation. That doesn't mean that rich people shouldn't pay taxes.
The problem that we have, though, is the caller that said his mom lived off dividends. Our interest rates are so artificially low right now that anybody trying to retire on any kind of savings is really just out of luck. And we need to figure out a way that they can save for themselves to offset so that you can have private investors save for their own retirement and earn a reasonable dividend that's not taxed at an exorbitantly high rate.
Well, they can put their money into a pension.
It's at risk.
they could put their money into a pension. But, Mike, you know, I don't disagree with you that interest rates are absurdly low and that it's hard for anybody to live on retirement. But that, you know, Paris Hilton making presumably millions of dollars a year in capital gains, or Mitt Romney, we know, you know, he's making tens of millions of dollars a year in capital gains and paying a maximum 20% tax rate. I haven't heard anything from you that justifies their having their income taxes capped at 20%. It was 15% up until a few months ago, having their tax rates capped at 15 or 20%, whereas the surgeon who saved my wife's life, he's going to have to pay up to 39%, and I have no problem with that surgeon making, you know, over $320,000 a year.
No, I understand. I think it's a difference of opinion. I'll tell you one other point, though, as a conservative.
Well, what's the difference of opinion? What's your justification for Paris Hilton paying a lower tax rate than the surgeon who worked on Louise?
Well, it gets into the difference between what you believe. You value labor more.
Labor
should have a preferential treatment over capitalists.
I'm saying they should have equal treatment.
And invested at risk.
I'm with Ronald Reagan on this. You grab that clip. I am with Ronald Reagan on this, that a bus driver and a millionaire should pay the same taxes.
I would support a flat tax if everybody paid the same.
I'm not talking about a flat tax. I'm talking about whatever the income tax rate is that, you know, with regard, you know, that there should not be loopholes in the tax code that are just there for rich people. You got that, Shane? Listen to this, Mike. Just listen to this. This is Ronald Reagan talking about the capital gains rate. And by the way, he did something about it.
We're going to close the unproductive tax loopholes that have allowed some of the truly wealthy to avoid paying their fair share. In theory, some of those loopholes were understandable. But in practice, they sometimes made it possible for millionaires to pay nothing. But a bus driver was paying 10% of his salary, and that's crazy. Do you think the millionaire ought to pay more in taxes than the bus driver, or less?
More, says the Republican audience. And Ronald Reagan was the only president since in the 20th century, to the best of my knowledge. I don't think FDR could even pull this off. I'd have to go back and look at a chart. He raised the capital gains tax rate up to 28% when he dropped the maximum earned income rate down to 28%. Ronald Reagan said that Paris Hilton should pay the exact same tax rate as my wife's surgeon. And I'm agreeing with him. I don't understand why you would disagree with him, Mike.
I would disagree with him.
Why? What is Paris Hilton doing that's morally superior to a guy who operates on women with breast cancer?
Again, I think it's the value of the dollar and where you put it on, whether it's labor that produced the dollar. There's this production, consumption, capitalist discussion that you always have, and I think that the capitalists, by the time they've made that dollar, has already put it at risk multiple times, and it's been taxed multiple times.
This is gibberish.
Now, if you were willing to change the tax code so that
Mike, that's total gibberish. If Paris Hilton is taking $1 million and investing it, yes, she's putting some money at risk, and she might lose that money. But I guarantee you, the surgeon who operated on my wife, every single day he wakes up, he's risking having a door close on his fingers and breaking a finger and losing his occupation for the rest of his life.
Yep.
So, again, what is he doing that makes him morally inferior to Paris Hilton?
So let's change the tax code. Let's correct the problem here. I think that the problem is you want the dollar as it moves through the economy to be taxed at an equal rate.
I think a dollar is a dollar is a dollar. That whether you earn your money with money or whether you earn your money by the sweat of your brow or the thoughts of your mind, it should be taxed the exact same rate.
I agree with that 100%, and that's why we need tax reform. And if you got rid of a 50% inheritance tax and all of the business taxes.
Oh, wait a minute. The inheritance tax is a whole different thing. We're talking about capital gains here.
Okay. So what I'm saying is,
you get rid of the capital gains tax, suddenly we don't have a deficit anymore.
Okay. What I'm saying is, if you want capital gains tax at the same rate or labor, then you have to set some of those other tax rules to where they offset one another.
Why?
I don't think you can you just want to go after one group of people.
Yes, absolutely. I want to say that the Paris Hiltons and the Mitt, I beg your pardon? Oh, 1 minute. I want to say that the Paris Hiltons of the world and the Mitt Romneys of the world can no longer have a tax loophole where they only pay 20% income tax on money over $320,000 a year. When they start making over $320,000 a year, that's how much my wife's surgeon at that point, he has to start paying 39% income tax. So should they. And that doesn't require us to do anything to inheritance taxes. It doesn't require us to do anything to sales taxes or any other kind of tax. And it will bring in an enormous amount of money into our economy. And frankly, I think it'll cause people to behave a little more rationally on Wall Street.
I'm rooting for you guys on one other thing, though.
What's that?
I'm rooting for you guys to lift the cap off Social Security, because the minute you guys change it into a wealth redistribution program instead of a fixed benefit insurance program, you'll kill the program.
How so?
Because you're going to turn it into a wealth transfer program where
it already is.
I see more in, do I get more out, or are you going to means test it?
Oh, no, you don't have to means test it. All you do is lift the cap and everything is fine. I mean, you know, the means test is the solution to not lifting the cap. Turn it into a welfare program. And you're right. If you were to means test Social Security, which is what Simpson and Bowles are talking about, means testing Social Security and or Medicare, and what Paul Ryan wants to do, you will kill it because you turn it into a welfare program. And it's so politically easy to kill welfare programs. Mike, I agree with you on that. And therefore, it should not be done. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have the latest news on the state of the sequester, plus what's happening in Congress this week, the best of the rest of the news. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. Ain't a spectator sport. Get out there, get active. Move to amend.org, pdamerica.org. Check it out. Tag you're it.
Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.